This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go? This week is part two of our interview with Chad and Alta Dillard. Luke is helping me with this one. He was not around for the first part, but we recorded part two and part three together. So part three will be coming up eventually. We let them discuss their very odd experiences, and they just get weirder and weirder as they go. I also want to thank everyone who gave me feedback on last week's show on Kundalini. I appreciate the support. That was a hard show for me to do, and so many of you wrote me and had comments and experiences to share. It was awesome. Also, I plan on doing another show about listeners' experiences. So if you have some experiences you'd like to share, you can email contact@wheredidtheroadgo.com and I can record you, or you can just send me the story. I've had a few people now send me stories they don't want to read them, or they don't want to talk about themselves, but they'd like me to read them. So that's a possibility. Or you can contact me and I will set up a time and we will connect and you can tell your story. And I will put together a group of those probably for sometime later in the summer. So, whenever I have about an hour's worth of stories from you, the listener. Without any further ado, let's get into this high strangeness with Chad and Alta Dillard. All right, Chad and Alta, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks again for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
And let's see if your phone connection holds up good, because you said you're right outside of Fort Knox.
Yeah, it must be all that gold interfering with
that gold that we're pretty sure isn't there.
Yeah, I've heard those rumors that it's not actually there, that a lot of the world's gold is missing.
Right. A lot of everything is missing. And this all area seems to have a lot of military all around us. So, you know, these signals, you just never know.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get back into what happened to you following your encounter in the French Quarter.
Okay, so that would have been around in September of 97. I would say coming out of that experience, me specifically, I was just going through all kinds of trauma, internal trauma, emotional trauma. I have this object in my upper arm. I preface myself because Chad seemed to be okay, Jacqueline seemed to be okay, but I wasn't. And what I mean by that is something was really changing inside of me. And it started off with all the ranges of emotions. I started off extremely angry about, you know, this unseen force involved in our lives. I tried to take the object out of my arm myself because I was so angry. And This internal voice made it real clear to me that that was going to hurt real bad when I put a knife to my skin, because I literally was going to cut this out myself. And it's just underneath the top layer of skin, but the object seems to move. It'll bury itself all the way down to the bone, and then there'll be times where it'll actually be standing out in my arm like a big bug bite. So, very tricky, and just lots of, as I said, a lot of emotions involved in it. And so when I realized that I wasn't going to cut it out of my arm, I didn't know where to turn. There was no place to turn. There was no one to talk to, no support system whatsoever. And so it took me about a year, from 97 to 98, to make up my mind that I was leaving New Orleans. I was going to leave the French Quarter, and I had no idea where I was going. But I was driven, compelled, to leave that area. And I felt that I was being drawn almost to the Southwest again. And I told Chad, I basically gave him an option or not option. I just said, I've got to go. I have to leave here. And I'm going back to the Southwest. And I knew that I had really no idea where I was headed, but New Mexico was all I felt inside of me. It seemed to be my, you know, the direction that seemed to be the most obvious to me. And so Chad agreed, and it took us about a year to put those plans in action. I actually tried to quit my job. The family that I worked for were determined that I wouldn't leave them, and so they had an option for me. They said that they wanted Chad and I to consider going to Denver, Colorado for them to open up a new business, a new shop. And I have childhood memories from living in Aurora, Colorado when I was little, and for some reason inside of me, I never wanted to return to Denver either. But thank goodness the people that I worked for, you know, hung in there with me. And so they said, well, go do what you got to do, and, you know, you may find that you want to go to Denver. And so ultimately, Chad and I, now we're into 1998, moved to New Mexico. We landed in Albuquerque with no direction. Again, I'm sounding absolutely crazy, but I'm feeling compelled inside myself to do these things. And Chad was just agreeable, thank goodness. You know, I'm not sure, but he was a willing participant. And so we ended up in Albuquerque and, you know, spent a great deal of money getting ourselves set up there, so on and so forth. I was allowed to continue my job over the phone. And I had a lot of clients over the years that continued to keep supporting me. It took us a few months of being in Albuquerque for me to realize that's absolutely not where we were supposed to be. I tried to get help in the sense of I reached out to, with no book of rules and nobody guiding us, I called a gentleman that at the time was was somebody involved in MUFON. I didn't even know really what MUFON was. And he wasn't polite at all. There was nothing nice about this gentleman and me. In the conversation on the phone, I knew that I had made a mistake reaching in that direction. Mm. And he wrote me off as just literally a crazy. And he said he was tired of all the crazies coming to his state. Because I think, you know, my understanding was his interest was, you know, flying crafts and anything that was tangible. And people like ourselves were just crazy. And he all but hung up on me. And so that gave me a real bad taste in my mouth about reaching out any longer. So, again, Chad and I are just operating off of emotions with, you know, nowhere to turn. I came outside of my house one day while we're living. We ended up right off of Route 66 in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I stepped outside of the house and I looked up in the mountains surrounding us and I said to Chad, we're going up there. And I pointed. And next thing I know, we're taking day trips up into those mountains and we discovered a small community up there that was a very small little village that has become quite famous since then with lots of movies being made in that area and so on. But it was still very small and very quaint, and it's called Madrid, pronounced Madrid, spelled like Madrid, and it's a very strange area, needless to say, and it also is just a couple miles from a smaller village called Cerrillos, New Mexico, and I bring that out because since all of this has happened to Chad and I, there's a man that's becoming quite well known in the country named Andrew Bishago. And Andrew Bishago claims that he has been part of a secret program from childhood, and I think he's in his 50s now, that his claims are that he and many others as children were time-portaled.
Oh, yeah.
You know who I'm speaking about.
Yeah, and he claims to have gone to Mars with Obama or whatever.
Exactly. Well, I wouldn't even be bringing him forward with the exception of this. When I, after all of our experiences, and I started really listening to people out doing interviews on these types of shows, one time I'm listening to Bishago, and all of a sudden he mentions Cerrillos, New Mexico, as one of the locations he was time portaled into. And needless to say, that got our attention because we had been living up in that area and went through very, I call all the paranormal high strangeness. We had a lot of high strangeness happening to us up there. And so just the fact that he, you know, chooses that location to go public about just really got my attention. But I'll have Chad share with you about his encounter with what we call a black-eyed man rather than a black-eyed children that you hear so much about in this small community called Madrid.
Well, when we first started going up there, we befriended a couple of guys, and one of them was just this, you know, old, cool, really laid-back hippie. You know, went by an alias, you know, a lot of them did up there. And, you know, he was just really, he even offered to open up his home to us, you know, to rent. And, you know, when we told him that we were looking for a place up there.
Actually, he really wanted us to live on his property, which was strange.
Yeah. Oh. And so, you know, we didn't, but we found another place back in, he was in Cerrillos, and we had found another place that was an old coal mining house where the coal miners lived. And but there was this little saloon, and when I say saloon, it was from way back in the cowboy days. Still had the hitch and post out there, and a lot of the old timers still rode their horses and tied to the hitching post out front. And we had kind of met a few of the local colorful characters there, and we all go to the bar that night and, you know, eat and having drinks, and we're sitting around this big round table. There's probably 8, 9, 10 of us, and as the night wears on, Alta's kind of sitting across the table from me, and this I'm sitting next to this hippie guy. And as this guy starts to drink a little bit more, he gets kind of really, I don't know, his mood, his, you know, and it wasn't just from drinking. It was just, you know, he started changing his attitude, and because he was always a nice guy. And all of a sudden he said something just really ugly towards Alta and I, and, you know, and I'm the only one that caught it. And I look over at him, and he looks at me, and his eyes are just totally black. I mean, there's no pupil, there's no white around the eye, there's nothing. It's his whole eyeball is black. And all of a sudden, I just kind of put up a spiritual block, I guess, without knowing what I'm doing. And, you know, he kind of backed down and turned around and left pretty abruptly after that. So that was pretty crazy.
Right. You know, nothing like our lives have been abnormal from the beginning, but neither of us had ever encountered, you know, anything of that nature, anything like that. And
Chad is
very clear about how this guy shifted just that quick. You know, it was an evilness, a something that seemed non-human in the change. And as Chad describes it, the eyes completely changed.
Wow.
So, and keep in mind, as Chad indicated, this guy lived in this little village that Bishago claims he's been time portaled in and out of. We had a lot of, you know, for the months that we lived up there, we had quite a few people might want to use the word coincidental, but we're so beyond that, that that word doesn't seem to apply to us in any way. Such as when we get up into these mountains, you know, it's as rural as you can get, other than I think where we're sitting right now outside of Fort Knox. And at that time, these people who lived up in these villages were, many of them were Hispanic natives who'd lived there, you know, thousands of years. And many of these people had no television, nothing like cable. I mean, heaven forbid in 1999, 98, that they've got cable up in the mountains. And again, that's just unheard of to Chad and I. We're city folk. And so
right.
I decide, you know, we come in peace, and we decided, Chad and I, that we'd have a big party to sort of introduce ourselves to some of these people. And we started it off by ordering, we couldn't get cable, and we couldn't get a telephone. We kept being promised a telephone, and that never happened. And a lot of bizarreness associated with trying to get a phone, real craziness. But just back to the television part of this, we had to order a satellite dish. So we decided about the time we were getting satellite put in, New Orleans was about to have a big hurricane hit it. This was not Katrina. This was, you know, fairly common in that part of the country, hurricanes.
Right.
So what folks do there is they have hurricane parties. And so we decided we would, you know, have a hurricane party with the locals and new satellite and invite everybody over. It kind of felt like a old Petticoat Junction show. If you ever saw that old television show, that's what it felt like we were living in the middle of, this very strange community. So the day that we have this party, at the time, Chad and I had a big black Great Dane and a Roddy Dobe that were our babies, because we've never had children. So our babies have always been critters. And so literally, Chad is bartending. The dogs are blocked on the stairwell where all the neighbors and all the friends that we'd invited over could see them, but we kept them away from everyone, but everybody was visual. And then everybody's sitting around the TV, and it's, you know, it's like something out of the 50s with people just getting television. And I walk over and I realize, you know, it's time to turn the TV on and let's watch the hurricane move into New Orleans. And literally the minute I turn the TV on, rather than a hurricane hitting New Orleans, what we see is Chad and our two dogs, that Great Dane and that Roddy Dobe, literally walking across the screen of the television. Now, with my mouth hanging open, and it's hard to make me speechless, Chad is over in the other end of the house, you know, playing bartender and host. And we've got all these people that we're trying to say we come in peace, you know, we're friendly and we have no ulterior motives kind of party. And there they are, my family, walking across the screen of the television. And right. So, you know, it was one bizarreness after another the whole time that we were there.
And how long did that last with the image on the television?
It was fairly brief, but what it was I'll have Chad describe to you why he was on television with the dogs. Keep in mind that what he's about to describe to you had happened months prior, if not a year or so prior to us moving up into these mountains.
Yeah, when I was in the French Quarter, I used to take care of some of the ladies that had their shop. I'd go by and help change light bulbs and, you know, just do different odd jobs for them. And this one particular shop I went into was called Three Dog Bakery. And they had yappy hour instead of happy hour and stuff like that. So one day the lady called me up and said, you know, because our dogs were so unusual and big and black and just awesome.
Yeah.
she goes, oh, you got to bring your dogs down. Animal Planet's coming down to film. And, you know, I want you guys there. So, you know, I tied their favorite handkerchief around their neck and prettied them up. And we trotted on down there. And so, you know, they filmed us, you know, in this Three Dog Bakery, and then
in the French Quarter.
And this was, you know, again in the French Quarter, and again, like Alka says, you know, this was, you know, months prior to us moving or even leaving New Orleans. So, and then to turn it on, and it, you know, the television happened to be on that station. That show happened to be on at that exact time was just beyond coincidence. It was just people were like freaking out, like, this is a tape. And I'm like, no, this is television.
Needless to say, they were more nervous about us from that moment forward, and there was no undoing it.
Yeah, well, the Luke, do you have anything you want to throw in?
No, it's all very interesting. I mean, as I was saying to you earlier, usually people who have paranormal encounters or people who have conspiracy theories, they have a single theme or some set of common characters, but you two seem to be at the right place at all the wrong times and have almost everything included.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm asked for, I think. I mean, we can't even this far into it, understand what in the world is happening to us. I mean, there's no answers for us whatsoever. It's just, it is ongoing, and we have discovered it, you know, that we'll get into later if you're interested, other family members on Chad's side that are having familiar encounters. So, I mean, it's just bizarre.
The gentleman
that owned that saloon that we were speaking about, when we first got up into those mountains, of course, we had to go in the saloon because, as Chad said, it looked like something straight out of the 1800s. And so it was afternoon. The place was emptied. There was nobody there but the owner. And when he, walked up to us to introduce himself and ask what we wanted to drink, the first thing that Chad and I saw when we walked in this big saloon were row after row of frozen daiquiri machines. Now, we're just leaving the French Quarter of New Orleans, where that's on every corner. But I've lived in lots of places in this country and never saw frozen daiquiri machines anywhere but New Orleans. And so to walk into this saloon out of the 1800s with all these daiquiri machines, and come to find out this guy that owns this place had been our neighbor in the French Quarter and had left 7 years prior to move up into this. I mean, it's just this kind of bizarreness that there are no explanations for. If this is coincidence, you know, we need better odds.
it seems to be sort of the trickster component being mixed into it all.
Totally. That's my favorite word. High strangeness and trickster.
It's like the universe is kind of playing with you.
Totally.
Laughing and pointing.
Yeah, pointing and laughing.
So what other experiences did you have up there?
Just, there was, I'm trying to think right now, because we weren't there too many months. I mean, it was, the fact was is that we were promised a telephone, because everybody has a telephone by 1998 somewhere.
Right.
And I have to have a phone. My job is dependent on it. And so we made arrangements of that before we left Albuquerque and moved up there. Well, just the short story on that business was, every time we were waiting for that phone to be installed and had been promised, obviously, we start getting form letters from the phone company, and they were asking for over $200,000 either to be paid by cash, a check, or money order. Now, we're reading this form letter saying, what is this about? It was somewhere close to $300,000 they were asking from us to put a phone in. So Chad would march over to the little payphone, the only thing that existed in this small community, at this little local, like I said, Petticoat Junction kind of bed and breakfast. And he'd have to make these phone calls to the phone company saying, what, you know, where's the phone and what is this about? And they would apologize to him and say, oh, we'll get that installed for you. Well, we got a second form letter. It was identical to the first form letter, but they dropped 10,000. Like, really? Are you kidding me? And so come to find out, Chad, of course, he can explain what that was about, but more of the strange experiences that we were having up there.
And what it was all of the numbers, you know, on all the telephone numbers were taken out of the box, you know, the main line, and all the numbers were taken. So they were going to have to install new lines from Santa Fe. That was the closest, biggest city.
Which was like 25 miles away.
Yeah, so they were going to have to put in all new line and open up a new big box. So they were expecting us to pay for all that in the big box so everybody can, you know, so they'll have more numbers, you know.
Right, of course.
They just never bothered to tell us this until we get ourselves relocated up there waiting for a phone to be installed. So needless to say, we couldn't stay because, again, my income, so on and so forth. So the people that I worked for out of New Orleans who highly desired for us to go to Denver for them, they had been in business in the French Quarter, a family-owned business, since 1929. They had never expanded outside of the French Quarter before, and so this was going to be their big launch. And, you know, the gods were in their favors because there was no way Chad and I could stay. And so I finally, against my will, agreed to move to Denver for them, you know, to keep my job and so on. And so it was within months of us up there and the cost. And, I mean, it was just unbelievable. Chad and I then had to leave and then move to Denver. So now we're in 1999 Denver. And it just so happens, you know, again, I had a sickness in my stomach because I had lived in Aurora, Colorado when I was little, and that was my first memory, my first childhood memory, was being tested for ESP in a hospital there. And so that was, it was still very uncomfortable for me, lots of still mystery about all of that for me that I can't get answers to. And that, you know, was weighing very heavy on us going to Denver. We get to Denver. We rent a large home at the time for all of our stuff and our belongings. And we're just going to have to play it out. And it so happens that Chad was involved in building this new shop with the owner from New Orleans and some of his, you know, helpers, if you will. Chad had a great deal to putting that new shop in. We finally get that shop open. Jacqueline, who was the woman that was taken with Chad and I, or had this encounter in 97 off that street corner, Jacqueline still worked for the family business, and she wanted to come to Denver. So it was just a natural that they would send her there to manage this shop. So now Jacqueline has now relocated to Denver as well. In the meantime, Jacqueline has had a baby, because when this event happened to us in 97, none of us had had children. So Jacqueline's had a child who's just turning a year old at this point. I might add, it appears that Jacqueline is pregnant within a couple months of us being taken off that corner. Her and her new baby and baby daddy all come to Denver. We open up this new shop, and we're about to have a big, grand, you know, introduction to the city of Denver that we're there, and it's early morning. I remember it's somewhere around 9-ish in the morning. The three of us are getting ready for the day and so on, and it was like it was the end of the world. Every siren that existed exploded around us, and we were just up the road a piece from Columbine. And this was when the Columbine Massacre took place. And when that happened, I immediately stood up. I'll never forget it. And I looked at Chad and I said, we are so out of here. We are so out of here. And it took very little time, just a few months after that. We were shutting down that shop and literally moving back to the family, decided they didn't want to follow through with it after they had invested a lot of money. And so next thing I know, we're relocating again back to New Orleans. And so by this time now, it's, you know, the end of 99, and we're now into the year 2000, and we've made a huge circle at a huge expense, really, to serve no purpose other than the high strangeness and the trickster. And then we're back, starting all over again, where it all seemed to begin.
Wow. Okay.
Right. We're still trying to recover.
So you're then back in Alabama?
No, we moved back to New Orleans.
Oh, New Orleans, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you went to Alabama.
Right. That was in 2000. And it took, you know, about the year of 2000 for literally Chad and I to fall completely apart at the seams. Whatever we were holding it together with, was we were coming completely undone. And
did you have more experiences
in New Orleans?
Did you have more experiences?
Lucky us, when we returned to New Orleans, I told Chad, I said, I'll go back to New Orleans, but I said, I will not go back to the Quarter as long as we live outside of the French Quarter. So we, as I said, lucky us, find ourselves literally renting a haunted house, and I mean haunted, and a very alive house. And on the surface, it all looked quite beautiful because we were surrounded in some of the most beautiful cemeteries you've ever seen in your life. And I can't think of a better neighborhood than to be surrounded in beautiful cemeteries because, you know, the neighbors don't bother you, no noise. It was the house that was haunted and alive and scary. And what I mean by that is lots of craziness had happened in that house prior to us moving into it. We discover after we move into it, we started to learn the history of the house. Lots of death in that house. Any couple who lived there separated or fell completely apart. Now, I don't generally buy into this kind of thing, but it was truly happening to Chad and I. And I remember one particular event where I'm sitting and watching television in the living room, and on the surface, everything looks so lovely, but it's the undercurrent that is so scary about this place. As I'm watching television, I had a crystal sphere sitting up on top of my television on a stand, and that sphere didn't fall off. It flew off of the top of my television across the room, and it had pretty good weight to it and hit the wood floor, and there was a dent. I mean, it was scary. It was very scary. And so needless to say, there's a lot to that, but Chad and I separated. He chose to go to Alabama, where his father was living, who is in his own business, in the locomotive business, and I was not willing to go there, and so I stayed behind. And so that kind of then, if you will, took us off into a different route, because now Chad and I are separated, and he's living in Alabama. We were apart about 3 months, and finally we got reconnected, and I chose to move to Alabama to be with him. And again, the high strangeness just amped up all around us. Everything just took off running from that point forward.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Do you think that your moving into places or going to places where there happens to be activity, or do you think you guys are actually drawing the activity out of the places?
Oh, what an amazing question. Wow. Chad?
I don't know. It's kind of like, I don't know. Maybe it's like a magnet. We're drawn to it, and it's drawn to us. It's kind of a two-way street.
Okay. Now, when you guys were separated, did one of you have more experiences than the other? Did it quiet down for either of you?
As far as I'm concerned, it really did. Now, one thing I did, and I don't know if I went over this in our last interview, but one thing I did learn that my dad was having experiences. The craft that we had seen in 1995, my dad saw it. My dad and my stepmom, they go down to Cancun for the millennium. And, you know, I'm telling them this story, what we saw in Hammond. They were familiar with the area, and I was telling them about the story of what we had seen in Hammond.
In 1995.
In 1995. And my stepmother's kind of looking and, you know, with her mouth wide open, like, you know, your dad and I went down to Cancun for the millennium for 2000. And he said, we go down at night to watch the fireworks. And we decide that the lights from the hotel was just really, you know, interfering with enjoying the fireworks. So we move up the cove. And she said, we set our chairs up. And when we set our chairs up, we set them up down below this Temple of the Puma. And she said, as soon as we got set down, all of a sudden, this big cat screamed out of the jungle. And she said, you know, they kind of, you know, all kind of gulped and then, you know, went on to start watching the fireworks. And she said, as the fireworks are going off, they see this craft in the sky. And she said that it looked exactly like how I described the craft that we saw in 1995.
Wow. Okay. Now, Luke, you also had another question for them about the way they felt when they had their encounter back in 95, and I totally glossed over that. I'm sorry, 97.
Right. Well, I was noticing when I was listening to the first part that the language you two use to describe how you feel during the night of 1997 almost seems like the feelings are influenced by the beings, you know, around you, in the sense that you feel bliss because this tall blonde woman is giving you this feeling of bliss. Or when Chad, you talk about the blue figure with the metallic object in his hand, you sense his aura, or the metallic object with lights that is, you know, almost surprised by you, you can sense its intelligence. And I was wondering if that's, I mean, is it similar to how I'm describing it?
As far as I'm concerned, I feel that you're hearing that, for the most part, very properly, or at least the way we're trying to relay it. I will say this, that I don't know necessarily that it was the blonde being in my case that was all about the bliss. It felt to me, as I kept repeating, when I'm in that encounter, I felt I was home, that I knew I was home. Wherever that was, wherever that crater was, whoever she is, I felt home. And that home, that sense of home, was so essential to my being, because I don't know that I've ever felt that before. So in my particular case, it felt like the all-encompassing. She just was the cherry on top, if you will, you know, in regards to my experience. Chad, in regards to, was it the blue being?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the blue being was just so, his aura, his presence was just so inviting, so caring.
Okay. So you kind of had this empathetic feel for what they were also feeling.
Yes. In my case, yes.
Okay. It's very interesting.
If I may add, Soraya, just backing up for a moment that feels just important to get it said, when Chad and I are separated and I'm still in New Orleans, you asked about any other, I think, high strangeness or, you know, bizarreness or whatever taking place. I don't really remember specifically other than I felt that I was in a survival game. I became very sick. I started becoming very ill and almost immediately when Chad left. And so I became a workaholic and was not taking care of myself and just getting sicker and sicker. And towards the end of that 3 months, I remember very clearly it was a beautiful afternoon and I'm walking through the quarter after work and the streets are very busy. And all of a sudden, I hear somebody yelling my name, and I look over, and it's an old friend that I had not seen in years. And he happens to be from Montauk originally. He had relocated to the quarter years prior, as we all had, and we found each other back in 1995, when Chad and I first moved to the French Quarter. So we've been friends for about 5 years or so. Hadn't seen him in a long time. He hollers my name. We get reunited. He said, let's go have a drink. We sat at a little outdoor cafe. He's drinking a Coke. I think I ordered a beer. And again, everybody's sober. There's no drugs involved here. There's no alcohol really involved here. I don't even remember drinking the beer. As we're sitting and trying to play catch up, of course, he's shocked that Chad and I are not together. He also was aware that I was sick. I was starting to look sick as well. You know, it was becoming apparent. And as we're visiting, talking, trying to play catch up, all of a sudden out of nowhere, and I mean, this came out of left field. This was as weird as everything else to me. He says, have you heard about Will? And I said, Will? Are you talking about Dark Boy? How do you know Will? And I don't even remember him responding to me. And Will is the young man that was the shapeshifter that I call the Wolfie Boy from Jacqueline's days. And he says, yeah, he says, Will has gone around telling everybody that he's catching a bus out of town because the aliens are after him. Now, that freaked me out so bad because it was, whoa, it was, now it's hysterical. But at the time, again, I was gobsmacked. It was sure. Like, where the hell did that come from? And, it was like it had been set up. I just kept looking for the cameras. You know, it's like I'm always looking for the camera. Like, somebody's pointing and laughing, and it's candid camera, and somebody thinks we're important enough to play these jokes on. I mean, it was just that bizarre. So it wasn't long.
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe there's some intelligence somewhere else in the universe or outside the universe that picks people out and says, let's have fun with them.
Don't you know? Well, we've sure had it, I'll tell you. And we played our part well because for the most part, I'm written off as crazy. And
easy pickings.
And then again, just to top it off, you know, we get relocated to Alabama, of all places, and find out that his dad and his brother are having some of this bizarre type of experiences and encounters. So,
well, it's not unusual for those things to run in families too, which has always struck me as kind of odd.
Right.
Well, it's so like my mother saying, you know, in 1957-58, a UFO or a metallic craft came out of the sky and stopped her on the highway. I mean, it's just, people have always thought, because if they hear this story, that it's all coming from me. And I'm like, wait a minute, you know, Chad and I got arranged and his family seemed to be pretty active in this craziness as well. So it can't be all blamed on me.
So what at what point did you rejoin with Chad?
So we were apart about 3 months, and literally I collapsed on my job, was rushed to the hospital, and it was my employer who had Chad's father's phone number, Chad's number, I don't remember, and it was she that called and told them that I was very sick and with a lot of concern about if I was going to literally make it or not. And I always found that interesting as well, because I try to avoid doctors and hospitals like the plague. And with this object in my upper arm so obvious, I mean, you can't physically look at my arm and see it, but, you know, I'm imagining I'm being examined and so on, and nobody has taken note of this in my arm at all. Or they're not supposed to. I just don't know. But anyhow, Chad found out. His father tells him, you know, that I'm very sick. And, I mean, he's instantly coming there and getting me and then bringing me back to Alabama. And so we were apart about 3 months. So we're now into 2001.
Now, let me ask you something about your implant. Does it ever burn when you touch it?
No. And, you know, I just would like to preface, just for the purpose of the language, I certainly understand people calling these implants, but in my case, I have never used that term. I've always referred to these objects as unknowns.
Right.
Okay.
Because I have no memory of it being implanted. I have another object in my wrist from another encounter, and it's very different. Its behavior, its everything is very different than the first object. And so this is, again, my purpose of just using the language of unknown just for my own purposes, because, again, I have no memory of this first one being implanted. And the second object, that all came about in an explosion of light in my wrist. It's like my wrist exploded in light.
Right, and, yeah, I think you talked about that in the first interview.
Okay.
Yeah, so,
I've never had any burning. It's never, when I say it plays tricks, though, when I went in to get my original x-rays, it was via Dr. Lear who requested these x-rays. I was in communication with him long distance, and he's the one that gave me the guidance that I had to get these pictures before he, you know, would go any further with me. And so when I went in originally to get the first, there's a great deal to all of these encounters and these stories. But when I went in to get the original x-rays, this object refused to take a picture. And again, you can feel it, touch it, almost see it just underneath the top layer of skin when it allows you to. You can actually feel its perimeter. It seems to change shape. But it would not allow a picture until the third take. And the skeleton staff that was working in the doctor's office to x-ray my arm became terrified. That's a word that I use a lot of when I'm very aware of somebody afraid. Now, they're flipping out, because when you can see and touch and feel something that's as solid as this appears to be, and yet you take an x-ray 2 times in a row and get a perfect skeletal x-ray of my arm and there's nothing there, they're starting to really, again, a great deal to that story, but it seems to play tricks. And I finally, on the third try, I look up, literally just look up above me in this room, in this x-ray room, and I said, throw a dog a bone, give me a break. I got to have this picture. And then it took the picture. And so I went through that a second time when Dr. Lear required a second x-ray. It did the same identical thing. And the object that's in my wrist won't take an x-ray at all. It's only been detected by ultrasound. So.
Huh. Okay. Well, let's move back to Alabama. So you're both in Alabama at this point. This is 2001.
Right. Now, Chad has learned of his father's encounter or experience with his stepmother down in Mexico with that craft that looked identical to, or at least they say it sounded identical to what we were shown originally in 95 Louisiana. And then silly me, like I hadn't had enough. I hate being bored. I'm not really a Southern kind of girl. And I just decide all of a sudden, we only did this once, and I don't expect we'll do it again. But I tell Chad, let's join a ghosty hunting group. You know, it just started to get popular on television and whatever. And I was just so bored. And I thought, let's join this group and see what's out there. And, well, that was a big mistake on our part. And like I said, you know, I'm slow, but I eventually get it. This woman decides, because we're coming out of the French Quarter, New Orleans, she's real interested in us being a part of her group. She understands me to be a professional medium, and so she, I guess, maybe got, yeah, as Chad's saying, high hopes on me, on us, joining her group, and that was never my interest. I was just bored and was just curious, were ghosties real? And I certainly felt like they, you know, whatever that means, we'd certainly been experiencing the invisible a great deal. And so she asked us to meet her at a location to do an investigation. And she's got all the fancy equipment, the tripods and all the cameras. And it's just little old me and Chad. We don't even carry a camera. And so we show up at this. We had to drive well over an hour out in the boondocks of Alabama. And she has us meet her at a old mobile home that's sitting in an old mobile home park around a pond or a small lake. And right next to this old mobile home is a concrete building that I was more interested in than I was that trailer. The energy coming out of that concrete building really had my attention. And so, trying to give you sort of the short story on this, she never said anything to me at all what we were doing there. Just this was an investigation, and she just wanted to know what did we sense and what did I feel and what have you. So in a very short amount of time, I was able to determine that the old woman that had lived in this mobile home had died there, and that she didn't die in her bedroom. She died in her living room on the couch, and I went right to that. So this gal could see that apparently I could do whatever she thought I could do. I could do it. And she said that, now I never saw this, but Chad saw the red orb.
There was, she was taking pictures and video and stuff, but there was, this was when we were out in the yard.
And this is daytime.
Yeah, and there's this red orb kind of following Alto around.
Whatever that means, she captured this on film, this whatever this red orb was about. And so the next thing I know, when this, I believe it was the old woman who had died in this place, I believe it was her daughter or granddaughter, maybe it was her granddaughter, and an adult granddaughter who had small children herself, they had asked us if we would go visit some other family members at their homes that they felt was haunted. Well, by this time, I'm starting to be sorry that we ever got involved in this. And but we accept. We agree to out of politeness. Because I'm thinking, oh, my God, this isn't like the television shows. You know, we can't help. There's nothing we can do. I'm not here to try to prove anything. And I realized that I was in over my head. Well, out of politeness, we accepted. So we end up in two different family members' homes. It seemed like, I mean, we were there all day, well until close to the evening, examining one house that was way too scary for my liking in terms of its activity, what they were reporting. I knew there was nothing we could do. Then this granddaughter asked if we would come to her home and speak to her young son. And he was probably about 10, I'm thinking 9 or 10 years old. And he was not childlike in regards to his explaining to us what he saw. He was very adult. I remember when I met him, when we walked into this woman's home, she had her husband, boyfriend, whatever he was, and two other guys. The three of them were sitting on the couch, staring at the television, looking like they were scared to death. These guys looked like bikers, big, burly bikers that you can't imagine could get scared of anything. And yet they were lined up on that couch when we walked past and she sort of pointed them out as to who they were. They never stood up and wanted to talk to us or anything. They just acted scared to death. And I thought, what in the world is going on around here? She then had me go into the kitchen, brings out her little boy. I squatted down where him and I were like eye level. And he seemed very comfortable with me almost instantly. And he proceeded, I'll have Chad share with you, because it scared me so much what I was hearing out of him that I just kind of shut down. This is what he described that he witnessed at that mobile home where his grandmother or great-grandmother had died.
He said that he was out on the front porch, and he's kind of leaning over the middle rail, you know, because he's short, so he's kind of got the brace rail, and he's kind of leaning over the deck of the porch, and he's looking down, and he said, all of a sudden, this creature comes out from underneath the porch, and he said it kind of looked like a monkey, but it had lizard skin, and it walked out about 6, 7, 8 foot out into the yard, and then it stopped all of a sudden, and it turned around and looked at him. And kind of like, I guess, surprised to see him. He said it turned back around, took 3 or 4 more steps, and just vanished. It just disappeared into thin air. No bushes around. This was a clean yard. There were some trees there, but nothing bushy. Nothing that it could just, you know, run off into. He said it just disappeared into thin air.
And again, if that wasn't crazy enough, and he seemed so, I'm extremely sensitive, and it's not that you can't lie to me and get away with it. I'm sure many have throughout my life, but it truly felt as if this child was speaking his absolute truth. And so at this point now, I've just about had enough, and I'm kind of signaling Chad that I'm, you know, ready to get out of there. And next thing we hear is his mother then goes on to share what happened to her on that porch. I'll have Chad again describe to you what we were told.
She said that, you know, after all this activity, she decided to grab the family Bible and go out on the porch and start reading out of Revelation. And she said she's reading, and all of a sudden, something grabs her by the head of her hair. She's got this long blonde hair. She said it grabs her, pulls her down, and starts pulling her. And her boyfriend and another guy are there, and they grab her feet, and they've got her up in the air. And this thing's pulling her one way, and they're pulling the other. And, you know, like Alka said earlier, these were big, tough guys. And they've got her up in the air, and they're doing this tug-of-war out on this porch.
Well, I might add, that's enough. Now, we've had enough. We definitely have had enough. And I'm saying silently to Chad, never again. I swear, Chad, never again. I'll stay bored before I'll ever get involved in anything like this again. We got to go. At this time now, as I'm signaling Chad, now the family have tried to give us money. They've tried to pay us. They were so sincere about what was happening to them, and they were so appreciative of us giving them all this time. And of course, we're saying, no, absolutely not. And I'm so sorry that we can't do any more for you. If you are religious people, lean on your community, you know, to pray for you, pray with you, do whatever you need to do. And I'm so sorry, we can't do anything for you. And we have to go, you know, as we're trying to get out the door. Well, then we realize that what these three guys are sitting on the couch staring at in the television is the Weather Channel. Because as I look out the door, as we're starting out the door, it's still light out. The skies are literally turning black.
Yeah, this was a beautiful day.
Yeah.
I mean, we had been outside, and, I mean, this has just been a perfect, beautiful day.
Mm-hmm.
No hint of ugly, nasty weather.
No warnings, no nothing. But, again, it's like being on a movie set. It's like somebody said, okay, you know, let's get the tornado weather going now. And by the time we could get out of this house, literally enter our vehicle to drive away from this place, again, sirens are going off everywhere. And Chad and I realize we don't even know where the hay we're at. You know, we're new to Alabama, and we're out in the middle of Boone, Alabama. How do we get home?
This was before GPS, too, so.
Right. Yeah, this is, you know, 2001. So now we're caught in tornadoes. When I say caught in them, they're going off all around us. We're heading down the highway. Chad finally figures out the direction to get us home on. And as we're coming down the highway, everything's at a screeching halt. The traffic has stopped. It is pelting rain and hail. And there's a female, probably in her late teens, early 20s, running down the middle of the highway, screaming. Running towards us. And what we realize is, now Chad is, we look over kind of to the left, and I don't know how many hundreds of feet ahead of us, a tornado has just come across that highway, went up a small hill, and exploded a brand new house. It didn't hit the house. It exploded it like a bomb.
Right.
And this woman is screaming for help. So Chad's trying to jump out of the car. I'm trying to pull him back in because he's going to, you know, go do what he can do. But by the time, you know, he realizes there's already all kinds of people up there and he knows he'll probably be more in the way, I'm relieved. He gets back in the car. But now we're trapped. We are literally trapped in the middle of this tornado insanity. So anyhow, without sounding over-dramatizing, it was an insane day. It was my last ghosty hunt, and we finally made it home, you know, I guess safe and sound, just crazier than ever. So that
right at home, just kiss the floor and like, okay, never again, never, ever again.
Never again. So that was the beginnings of Alabama.
You said that was the beginning of Alabama?
Yeah, that was our beginnings of the high strangeness, the craziness, the insanity of Alabama. Alabama, I might add, most people don't realize this or they don't think about it, but it does also happen to be the home of NASA, which was only a few hours away from where we lived.
I didn't realize that. I guess I always thought it was headquartered in either Houston or Florida, but I guess that's just where they launch out of, huh?
Right. Werner von Braun, as in, you know, the head of the missile project and so on and so forth, he literally built a community called Huntsville, Alabama, which is something arsenal, Redstone Arsenal, and it was his town, and he built it, and NASA.
Huh. All right. All right, and that's where we're going to stop for part two. Part three will be on sometime in the next month or so. Upcoming next week, we have a live interview with Michael M. Hughes, and that should be really interesting. He's written some fictional books, Blackwater Lights and Witch Lights. He does write nonfiction, and we'll be talking to him about all kinds of different subjects, from the paranormal to shamanism, and of course we'll be discussing the inspiration behind his fictional work as well. So you can find more about him at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Also upcoming, we have Artie Sixkiller Clark, and she'll be talking about UFO experiences of the Maya people. We have Rick Strassman, which is a two-part interview. The first part dealing with his initial book on DMT, The Spirit Molecule, and the second one dealing with DMT and the Soul of Prophecy. And that's a fascinating talk. Went a little over 2 hours, so we're splitting it into two shows. In addition, we have Peter Robbins and Richard Dolan, who will be live in studio June 13th. They will also be doing a, for those of you that are interested, they'll be doing a what's called a Dealer's Choice show on WVBR, which is where the studio is located. And what that is a show where various hosts for the specialty shows on WVBR have 2 hours to do whatever they want with. So what I'm doing with it is I'm turning it over to Peter Robbins and Richard Dolan, and we're going to talk about whatever they want to talk about, and they're going to play music they love. So that will also be, you can tune into that live when it airs, which will be June 13th around 3 p.m. Eastern till 5 p.m. Eastern, or I will post a link to it to stream it afterwards if you're interested. All right, so we will see you next week with Michael Hughes, and here's some Psyche Corporation to take us out.
Shut the closet door, it's under the floor, the monster's there. Don't leave me here among these ghosts. You promised me nightmares the day I was born. You promised me hellfire, you were so sure I grew up waiting. Of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chew me, slake me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn, I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform, cause I'm a monster. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. This is a song I've heard before. It's like a voice asking for more. Ma chère éclate à cause des ailes. En grand spectacle de primavera. Yeah.